Hello, everyone from London and from New York, and welcome to today's program. In collaboration with Queen Mary University of London School of Law, Pinsent Masons, the AAA, ICDR, and NIAC. The issue at hand today, improved efficiency and flexibility in construction, arbitration, and infrastructure disputes. We're going to take a deep dive into key stakeholder perspectives. We'll look to industry perspective, the user's perspective, institutional perspective, the arbitrator perspective, and also third-party perspectives to peel away the benefits and inherent inefficiencies in the process. It is a small step towards offering you today the composite view of the data collected in the survey. 646 completed questionnaires with 66 personal interviews. The survey, you may ask, what are we talking about? It's the anchor of today's program, the 2019 International Arbitration Survey, Driving Efficiency in Construction Disputes. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and post it into the chat. You'll find it there, and it will also be circulated afterwards to all delegates. We're talking specifically faster, cheaper, transparent. How do we get there? Words that are often used as we try to remedy the inefficiencies in an arbitral process. It's significant, actually, and temporally, as this week, running at UNCITRAL is working group two, both in Vienna and virtually, where they're discussing just this in a fashion under their expedited procedures. We're going to look to items including amount in controversy. How does that tip towards arbitration being a preferred methodology? And so, before I introduce our speakers today, we're going to open our first poll. There will be several throughout as a way to increase our engagement with you. So please, if you would, poll number one is up, and let us know, who are you and what is your primary role? While your responses are collecting, allow me to introduce an all-star cast today. They'll be introduced in alpha order. And so to begin, Clea Bigelow-Nuttall. She is a senior associate in the London office of Pinsent Masons. She specializes in commercial and investment arbitration with a focus on infrastructure, construction, and mining projects. I'm posting Clea's bio into the chat as well. Next, we have Jason Hembury, a partner in the London office of Pinsent Masons and co-head of international arbitration. His practice focuses on energy, infrastructure, and manufacturing sectors, and he was one of the drafters of the 2019 survey. His bio forthcoming now. And we move to Luis Martinez, vice president of the AAA ICDR based in New York. He heads international initiatives along the East Coast in Central and South America, the Caribbean, Spain, and Portugal. You can find his bio now in the chat. And finally, last but not least, we have Lucas Mistelis, the Clive M. Shimatoff Professor of Transnational Commercial Law and Arbitration. He is also the director of the School of International Arbitration at the Center for Commercial Law Studies at Queen Mary University of London School of Law, based in London. He focuses his research on international dispute resolution and investment treaty law. Lucas was another main drafter of the 2019 survey, and his bio is now in the chat. With that, let's go ahead and end the poll and take a look at who we have. And I'm going to share the results with you all so you know who we're talking to today. We have 28% in the private practice sector, 9% in-house, 16% arbitrators, 3% working at arbitral institutions, 16% with technical expertise, no 30-party funders on the line, but we also have 13% academics and 13% other. Okay. With that, we're going to go ahead and go into our main topics at hand. My name is Rekha Rundachari. I'm your interlocutor today. Please, a few administrative items before we begin. The session is being recorded. Do share with your friends who couldn't join us today. Next, the views expressed today by the speakers are their own, not to be extended to their firms, their organizations, or their institutions. And finally, posit your questions into the Q&A chat within this portal. We will turn to them in real time as appropriate or at the end of the session. And so here we go. Scene setting. Lucas and Jason, what is the 2019 survey? Why did it come into the foray, and how is it changing the landscape? Please.
There you go. Can you hear me now?
Perfect.
That's like a poor Boris Johnson press conference, so I apologize for that. So thank you very much, Rekha. And a really interesting and diverse audience looking at that poll, which of course is reflective of the survey, which we did. I'll say a few words, and I'm sure Lucas will add a few comments as well. Just by way of background, so we conducted a major survey with Queen Mary University London in 2019, looking at efficiency in construction arbitration. It was the second major survey we've done with the university. This one focused on how international construction disputes can be resolved more efficiently. As Rekha said, we had a really fantastic response, around 650 respondents from diverse jurisdictions and backgrounds, right across the legal and construction professions, counsel, arbitrators, experts, in-house practitioners, institutional specialists, academia and litigation funders as well. The findings are in the report, which Rekha's just posted. That report was published in November 2019, significantly a couple of months before we started to see the lockdowns in our Asia-Pacific regions, and of course the subsequent lockdowns which followed after that. The survey essentially did three things. First of all, it confirmed that arbitration is still perceived as being the best available process for resolving disputes in international construction projects, which is good. What it also did, of course, is highlight the need for improved efficiency, because it's certainly, when you look at what the respondents were saying, arbitration is still perceived as taking longer and costing more than it should, even in very large value cases. And crucially, the other thing the survey did was look and see how that we can make that process more efficient and cost effective. It was really interesting when you look at what the respondents say, when you read the survey, the top factors which were selected in terms of how we can improve efficiency were around three things, really. Tribunal experience. I think there was a real acknowledgement and desire that parties want arbitrators who understand construction projects, construction contracts, and how risk is allocated under those contracts, resolving their disputes in construction arbitration. No real surprises there, of course. Also, I think a real appetite, and this was before COVID, of course, for tribunals to be a little bit more robust in dismissing bad claims. And we'll talk a little bit about that, I'm sure, in due course. And the other point was, I think, an appetite that tribunals should encourage parties to identify and agree issues in advance, and certainly in advance of substantive hearings with a view to cutting down the scope of those hearings. The survey also looked at where there was room for improvement. And the three main things which came out of that, I think, were poor case management, party tactics leading to prevaricated and lengthy arbitrations, and of course, due process paranoia. As I said, the survey was published right at the end of last year. And of course, since then, we have seen a real shift in the landscape, which has had a significant impact on how arbitration is used and conducted. Some good, maybe some not so good. And we'll look at some of those changes today by reference to the topics which have been covered in the survey. Before I hand over to Lucas, I think I'd like to endorse Rekha's point, which is I hope this will be a really interactive session. And looking at the spread of the delegates here, I'm going to be really interested on your views, to hear your views, really, on how the answers, attitudes and the needs of the construction sector that certainly dominated the discussion on efficiency up to the end of last year when the survey was published, how they have shifted as a consequence of the COVID pandemic, or as I like to call it, what the difference a few months makes. So with that, I'll hand over to Lucas to make a few comments.
Thank you, Jason. I will be very brief because I think you covered quite a bit of the background. Queen Mary has embarked on empirical surveys since 2006. And in the very beginning, we were only talking to corporate counsel. We didn't want to know what practicing lawyers or arbitrators think. So the focus was entirely on corporations. But from 2013, we started looking more specifically at industries. And it was very, very clear then that construction, as the statistics of institutions, so is the primary user of arbitration services. Of course, a lot of cases which are in the nexus of energy and construction, or technology and construction. So this is effectively the third sectoral survey. The 2013 was a broader survey. The 2015 was looking specifically at technology, media, and telecoms. And I'm delighted to let everyone know that Ancitral now is considering taking on work on high-tech and dispute resolution, very much on the basis of the previous Queen Mary and Peace Nations survey. But this one was very special because construction is so central to the economy and so central to dispute resolution. We wanted to look quite a bit about what happens in pre-arbitral processes, whether disputes boards, mediation, negotiation work or not. And the construction industry has spent quite a bit of energy in trying to develop these pre-arbitral processes. So that's one line of inquiry, which I thought was very, very important. And the results, I think, are quite important. We looked also at how investment treaty and construction started to interact a bit more, as well as the particular sort of concerns that parties have. And perhaps I would like to also formally thank Alex Ferguson, who was a full-time researcher working on the project. And myself and the Peace and Nations team have taken a role after the work has been completed in trying to package it rather than develop the interviews and the questionnaires. And no doubt, I think there's so much to be discussed, so we'll only be touching on a few issues today.
Okay, thank you so much, Jason and Lucas. So we're next going to go to Clea to give us this background of the impact of COVID from the industry perspective. And I'll raise in sequence as well as Clea takes us through the points. Filipa Cansado Carvalho, one of our delegates, has posited a question as to the advantages and challenges of using technology as particularly related to construction disputes. Clea, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Rika. When the survey was published back in November 2019, the three most common causes of international construction disputes were identified by respondents were late performance, poor contract management, and poor contract drafting. Suspension and termination of contracts was on the list, but it was some way behind those top three causes. And other issues that were identified frequently, less frequently still included disputes from government interference and insolvency. And against that context, and exploring what we're seeing coming out of the pandemic now, we find ourselves in obviously a very different set of circumstances. Since the start of the year, all of the major US indexes have fallen by between 10 and 20%, and the UK's economy has fallen by over 20%. So unsurprisingly, there's been a considerable refocusing across the industry in terms of reduction of capital expenditure and managing cash flow particularly carefully. The construction supply chain's been affected with disruption right across the sector, and this has been forcing parties to make some really difficult decisions. Does a party want to try and improve its cash flow position by pursuing claims in arbitration or another dispute mechanism, or do they want to keep that money in their pockets and try and weather the storm and hope for the best? Unsurprisingly, at the start of the pandemic, one of the very common issues that we were being asked about was the applicability of force majeure provisions in a contract and the ability of a party to rely on those provisions to claim for additional time or in some limited circumstances, even money. There's been a lot of debate about the point at which force majeure obligations are triggered. And given that some jurisdictions have seen a relative easing of restrictions after periods of strict lockdown, questions about when provisions of force majeure apply or cease to apply. And now in the UK, we're again facing a second wave of lockdowns, which could again raise questions about how or when force majeure circumstances can be considered to be continuing. We've also been seeing an increase in questions regarding applicability of change in law clauses and whether or not various forms of the government guidance and decrees that have been issued across the world in all jurisdictions constitute changes in law for which a party can make a financial claim under their contract, as opposed to just a claim for time, as is most common for force majeure. Finally, we've seen an absolute deluge of queries from parties regarding suspension and termination provisions under a contract and whether they're able to rely on those mechanisms in circumstances where they can't or haven't been able to renegotiate the terms of the contract. And this is a particularly sensitive issue because we've seen parties terminating contracts improperly almost as often as we've seen them doing it properly. And it's absolutely crucial that a party is considering hitting the nuclear option needs to seek careful advice on if or how to do so, so that they don't find themselves in a worse position than they were prior to termination. So given the types of claims we're seeing, I think if the survey were to be run today, the top three common causes may well look very different. For instance, we would likely see unforeseen risks, government interference, and insolvency all featuring far higher up the list of common causes. And the financial effects need to be kept in mind because looking at the circumstances with today's eyes, the pandemic is looking more and more likely not just to be a one-off event that has a start and a finish date, but something that's much longer lasting and is going to evolve with time, and in respect to which the construction industry will need to keep assessing and recalibrating how it takes account of it. Now, similarly, and with treaty disputes in mind, I'd like to speak about whether or not we have seen a potential for an increase in investor state disputes in the construction and infrastructure space as a result of the pandemic. The very short answer to that question is yes. There's a real clear potential for there to be a jump in investors in the construction and infrastructure sector, bringing claims against host states under either bilateral or multilateral investment treaties as a result of actions that have been taken, or in some cases not taken, by states to deal with the pandemic. Both the US and the UK have passed legislation which, amongst other things, impacts on site closures, social distancing in the workplace. Other countries have put strict lockdowns on essential and non-essential businesses, temporary requisitions on health and transportation assets, cancellation of bids processes for large state infrastructure contracts, and restrictions on import and export commodities. And in addition to these restrictive measures, some states have also brought in measures that have been intended to compensate businesses for losses that they have or will have suffered as a result of the pandemic. So undoubtedly, investors in all sectors, including construction, who feel that they've been harmed or unfairly treated or discriminated against by these measures, are going to be looking to what protections are set out in any applicable treaties that may be in place between the investor state and a host state. And the types of claims that can be brought will, of course, depend on the facts in dispute and the wording of any specific treaty provisions. But it's easy to envisage that where construction projects have been suspended or delayed or revoked, we will see an increase in claims for indirect appropriation. Additionally, in places where construction hasn't necessarily fallen within a category of strategic or essential work, we could imagine that investors might seek to argue breaches of fair and equitable treatments. And in circumstances in which a foreign investor hasn't qualified for state aid to compensate for its losses, then there may be claims for a right to national treatment or non-discrimination under a treaty. The potential is very much there for these types of claims to materialize. And in terms of the types of defenses that states might have in such cases, these will, of course, depend in the first instance on the wording of provisions in any treaty, and in the second instance, upon principles of customary international law. Now, treaties, the older generation of treaties, don't traditionally contain provisions which would provide for defenses that would allow states to defend against these claims, but the more recent generation of treaties, for example, the Netherlands Model BIT, the Canada-EU Trade Agreement, CETA, and the US-Mexico and Canada Trade Agreement, all contain provisions that non-discriminatory regulatory actions that are designed to protect public welfare objectives, such as health and safety, won't amount to indirect appropriations. The types of defences that states have tend to rely on in periods of disruption in the past, and I'm thinking of disruption of construction projects in the context of the Arab Spring against North African states, or in South America, in particular Argentina, in the context of the economic collapse there, force majeure defences and distress defences will be available. And those have been applied with more or less varying degrees of success. But I think it's fair to say that whatever comes next in terms of investor-state disputes in the context of COVID, we will see an increase in such disputes being brought. And this is something that will possibly have an impact on certain policy determinations on where investor state views go on a kind of a higher level going forward. And so with that, I'll stop here.
Thanks so much, Clea. So uptick in claims generally, as well as in the ISDS context, even more important on why we're talking about efficiency and best process. We're going to launch the next poll question. The question goes, do you think in-person hearings will soon be a thing of the past? With this, as we collect your answers, please do pull in. We're going to go to Jason. And Jason, can you talk to us a bit about the user's perspective, due process and its paranoia, and all things involved therewith? Jason, please.
I will do. I'm going to start just very briefly with technology, which links into this, because for me, it's really interesting. The report, when you read it, published, as I said, last November, is a 50-page report. And I think the first reference to technology appeared on page 49, so almost as a footnote. And when you look at what the respondents were saying to that, their view was that technology was adding to rather than improving the perceived inefficiencies of the process. And the reason cited around all of that were all around the typical old-fashioned, I'll call it, conventional blocks to technology. Respondents said tribunals and parties were struggling to use it. Other respondents said there were too many glitches in the software to make it workable. And to a more limited extent, concerns were raised about cybersecurity risks. And of course, since then, we have seen a real shift in attitude and approach. I think technology is going to be here to stay. And certainly one of the legacies of the COVID period will be that the institutions, I think, will be deploying technology a lot more going forwards. And in terms of the institutions, I think it's just worth noting that certainly the major institutions outside of the US, the LCA, the ICC and SEAC in Singapore, have all over the last few months been working remotely and deploying technology throughout the pandemic to ensure that arbitrations remain on track. And there's been a real number of positive changes as a result of that. For example, the ICC, requests for arbitrations and pleadings can now be lodged with them electronically. I'm pretty sure that's going to be here to stay. I think it's very unlikely to go back to the old system of physically filing hard copies and triplicate, etc. And we had a big moment, I think, in April this year when the ICC issued its guidance note to parties, counsel and tribunals to mitigate the effects of COVID-19 on ICC arbitrations. The guidance note was in two parts. Part A was largely a reminder, well, certainly a strong hint, shall we say, of the procedural measures and tools that are available to tribunals and parties to be used to ensure that arbitrations are resolved more expeditiously. Many of those were addressed in the survey. For example, dealing expeditiously with bad claims and defences, resolving issues in stages by more partial awards if it was thought it would lead to a quicker resolution of the arbitration, and more procedural conferences to drive efficiency. On the recent, on the current ICC arbitration I've been involved in, we had a procedural conference after the exchange of witness evidence, really driven by the tribunal to test the parties very carefully, almost on a paragraph-by-paragraph basis as to how much of that evidence was actually going to be needed and how it could be limited to cut down the scope of the substantial hearing in due course. Part B of that guidance note deals with virtual hearings, and Lewis is going to cover that in his session in a moment. But it does lead on to the second point, which I want to cover, which is this. There is no question, I think, that the greatest impact on the arbitral process has been that substantial hearings, evidential hearings, are being held remotely. But as beneficial as they are to keep arbitrations on track, do they give rise to due process concerns? Well, I'm going to make a number of points on that. But before I go there, I think it's just worth noting, I think, that virtual hearings in international arbitration are totally possible. In my view, they're an evolution of what's been happening in arbitration over the last 10 years. In fact, I think it's hard to think of an arbitration that hasn't had a virtual component, whether it's been telephone conferences, applications by video conference. But the difference, of course, is that we've moved to the entire substantive hearing being held remotely. And over the last few months during the lockdowns, rather than legal teams sitting together, we've moved to everyone attending from different locations, which has been a very different prospect. Now, I would say the goal of the virtual hearing is to replicate the physical hearing. I would also say that the concept of due process must apply to a virtual hearing as much as it does to physical hearing. Now, there's certainly been challenges, and I've seen that myself conducting a number of virtual hearings over the last few months. But where might they cause some procedural imbalance? I'll throw out a few thoughts for you to think about, and I'm sure we'll come back to this in the discussion in a moment. First off, I think there is an argument to be said that virtual hearings may not be appropriate in cases where the credibility of a witness is at stake. The issue which we've been wrestling with now for a number of months is how do you ensure that witnesses aren't being coached during their evidence or discussing their evidence with others during breaks. Some platforms like Opus 2 will allow 360-degree cameras so you can see the entire room. But where there is fraud or dishonesty in play, I would suggest that this still may not be appropriate, and it may well be better to adjourn until you can have a physical hearing. I'd also suggest that remote hearings might not be appropriate when you're dealing with complex evidence like competing forensic accounting models. The technology is good, don't get me wrong, but I'm not convinced it's quite good enough yet to be able to put detailed spreadsheets to experts and witnesses in a way that can be done adequately, and adequately, I should say, to allow tribunals to understand it properly, who are themselves also sitting remotely. And I think that can create a potential imbalance where a party is seeking to rely on an evidence to establish its financial case. I also think the pandemic over the last few months has compelled tribunals to hold their deliberations remotely, certainly in an international arena, over different time zones, particularly if they're based in different locations. Often, not always, but this is being done at the end of a hearing day or the end of a hearing week when the tribunal has spent many hours concentrating on the screen, which it, of itself, I think, has a negative impact on your period of concentration. I would suggest a high quality of deliberations is essential in order to ensure that due process and render a fair award. And while arbitrators can technically deliberate over Zoom or MS Teams, their inability, I think, to discuss all aspects of the case and review submissions and evidence in person could in some instances, I think, negatively impact on that decision-making process. What we've also seen is that in an endeavour to hear something during the COVID period, tribunals have effectively bifurcated the arbitration or bifurcated aspects of the arbitration to use the time that's been reserved for a full substantive hearing to determine certain issues of law or fact with a view to narrowing issues and promoting settlement. And that bifurcation, I'll put in inverted commas, has happened even when the parties haven't actually applied to bifurcate the proceedings. So it may result in expediency, but it raises a question as to whether that is fair. I think the other point to think about as well is the impact to different time zones, which can be a real issue and is certainly one of the unique features of arbitration, which often distinguishes it from many court proceedings. In my experience, I think tribunals sometimes have been too blasé about this, and it can lead to potential difficulties and unfairness. And I've personally experienced two ends of the spectrum. One end of the spectrum, we've had a tribunal who's recognised the difficulties this may pose and has therefore sat very short sitting hours and four-hour days to accommodate this. I've also seen the other side of the spectrum where the tribunal has said, well, look, the arbitration is seated in Asia Pacific. We're going to stick to Asia Pacific time zone. And that means that parties who are attending from the US are going to have to attend between 1 a.m. and 7 a.m. You know, that's just how the chips fall. I'm not sure that's necessarily great and arguably not necessarily fair. Finally, I think it's just worth remembering that where tribunals decide to proceed with a remote hearing without the party's agreement or where a party is objected, this could give rise to potential challenges. The ICC guidance notes suggest that when making that determination, the tribunal should balance a number of factors, the nature and length of the hearing, the complexity of the case, the number of participants, against whether an adjournment is going to cause unwarranted, excessive and therefore prejudicial delay. The guidance note expressly says that tribunals should provide reasons for its decision. I think that's because of a risk of a potential challenge. Understanding, of course, the guidance makes this point, that the rules, the ICC rules, are very supportive of virtual or remote hearings. So I think that raises interesting issues. I would say there are a limited number of jurisdictions in Europe where if parties ask for a real hearing, i.e. a physical hearing in person, then due process necessitates in those jurisdictions that you have a hearing in person. Fortunately, I'm pleased to say those jurisdictions are very few in number. So I think with that in mind, I think the question really is, once the COVID pandemic has retreated, will we likewise move away from technology? I think crystal ball gazing in the middle of a pandemic can be a dangerous exercise, but I think given the pressures around, I think it's unlikely. I think there's no question that going forward, procedural applications, procedural conferences will be done virtually. I think case preparation, interviewing witnesses, working with experts will involve more virtual than in-person sessions, particularly when your witnesses and experts are overseas. But as to virtual substantive hearings, I think in my view, for cases where the value of the dispute is low or where the issues are not lengthy or complex, I think tribunals and parties will be very strongly incentivized to opt for virtual hearings because of all the upsides, the savings on travel, accommodation costs, and of course, the environmental benefits they will have. However, I do think the benefits of virtual hearings will remain, especially when those hearings are expected to be long and complex, and the value in dispute is significant. I still think there's something to be said on the right hearing for having participants in the same time zone, in the same room without distraction, and allow to build the rapport that needs to be built to run an effective hearing and arbitration. So we'll pause with that and hand it back to Rekha, who I'm sure will open up some questions to the floor.
Yes, and I'm also going to share the poll results. Here we go. So unsurprisingly, to the question of will in-person hearings be a thing of the past, it will be a mix. Hybrid is the route of the future. Cognizant of time, what I think we'll do is continue with the perspectives. Thank you so much for those positing their questions into the chat. Very much appreciated, and we'll come back to them. One thing that Jason highlighted was that the flexibility often of arbitration rules of the institutions. And so, you know, the truth is many arbitral institutions have always had this optionality to take things virtual. But now even more so, there's been a spotlight on it. Luis, can you take us through the institutional perspective, what's happening at the AAA ICDR? And I'll go ahead and also include in the chat, lots of resources in the chat. If you're tuning in, I'll be putting up some of the AAA ICDR resources as well.
Thanks, Rekha. It's a pleasure to be with all of you today. And just to give you our perspective regarding the COVID-19 impact that has had on us as administrators of international and domestic construction arbitrations and mediations, and of course, all the other cases. It really has presented us with a number of challenges. In our over 95-year history, we, of course, had to deal with business disruptions before, including hurricanes and acts of terror that we all know. So we did learn from those past lessons, and we had a robust business continuity plan with many systems in place, of course, to protect data and our case management capabilities. But for this one, we really had to respond quickly because we had to comply with local legislation in many of the cities in which we operate that required us to quarantine and immediately stay at home when the cases started to escalate dramatically. I think the main challenge that we had to face was having to transition our workforce of over 570 staff to literally be able to work from home. The executives and a number of employees did have that capability, but with the closing of actually 28 offices in the United States, many, of course, with hearing rooms and facilities, where we were managing at that particular moment in time thousands of cases, we were faced with having to postpone and reschedule hundreds of hearings. We noticed, in fact, when we track the administrative tasks that we're doing at any given moment, the transition period in March, really, we almost had to come to a halt until we could gear up and start going forward with our teleworking capabilities. So that was really our top priority. We wanted to do that while keeping in mind, and we still do, the commitment to cybersecurity, confidentiality, data privacy, all important issues when you are migrating to a telework environment for a staff of this size. What we did was we provided all the administrative teams with AAA ICDR encrypted laptops. We're all using, of course, VPNs with secure phone apps. We have double password authentication. That's a requirement. So literally the laptop and the connection to the administrative systems is quite secure, but the transition definitely was a challenge. And now, for example, our international team is completely working remotely, but we have team status calls on a regular basis. So I could even argue that if you're going to have to look for some sort of a silver lining for us, it's been that I'm actually seeing my international colleagues on a more regular basis than I did before. I think we were greatly helped by the fact that we were already seeing an international arbitration. And as the colleagues here on the webinar have mentioned, there has been a complete migration to a virtual paperless system for some time now. Our electronic case management platforms are all connected. For example, our administrative teams use our own proprietary customized platform for all our case administration needs. So I log on, I see all my cases, I see what steps they're at, I see them color-coded red for anything beyond the time frame. And it's quite easy for me to have a clear handle on where my cases are progressing and at what stages they're at. Users have access to all of their AAA file and documents through our system called WebFile, and they can easily file and access their cases remotely, and they can see the status, they can handle financials and track them remotely as well. We do have resource pages for both our COVID-19 response, our virtual hearing response. You can access them through icdr.org and see all the various documents that we've put together for working remotely. And then finally, our AAA arbitrators, they have their own platform where they can access the cases that they've actually been assigned to, and it links all three platforms. So it's really a fully integrated remote administered system that now makes it quite easy for us to proceed in this manner. I think the other main disruption that we had to deal with impacting our traditional business model, and Jason touched upon that, is the fact that we did close our hearing facilities. And at the moment, it appears at least in the United States, will be closed throughout the remainder of the year. We have, again, we're dependent on what the local framework and legislation is. On some of our larger hearing rooms, we've all measured them out for social distancing, have to comply with buildings, security, and all those matters. But it is a significant challenge. And at the beginning, I would say, when we first started closing our hearing facilities, and as the schedule seemed to be extended because of the escalating cases, we thought that we would see an increase in the opting in to virtual hearings. And I would say there was at the beginning, but I would also say that was coupled with a reluctance. There was a hybrid, certainly, and there still continues to be that, where parties are certainly more amenable to the virtual hearings for procedural and scheduling and discussing the framework of the arbitration. But there still is that reluctance, especially in the larger cases, where you clearly have advocates who are respected and hired for their skill set to be able to present their case and their ability to convince a tribunal, that it doesn't translate as easily that skill set to this virtual setting. So I would say it's mixed. I'm seeing an increase, but as we all are, we're hoping that at least if you want to have the in-person hearings, that we'll soon get to a point where that is more of an option. Now, in terms of the documents that we put together for virtual hearings anyway, the main four, we put together one for the virtual hearings managed services. We immediately noticed that the Zoom platform seemed to be the most in demand from our users. So we identified and put together a training program for staff to be designated, if you will, Zoom champions. We analyzed how you should set all the settings for your Zoom hearings. We also have documents and hearing guides for arbitrators and parties using other platforms. But a lot of work was done to really gear us up to be able to manage these Zoom hearings effectively and not take care of the security and assist the arbitrators. So the tool has, it's more effectively being used. I think one of the main documents there is the orders and procedures for a virtual hearing for video conference. That model order that we proposed has really a lot of the elements that we think should be discussed. And for us, at a very early stage, we have a preparatory conference once the tribunal clears conflicts and we turn the case over to them with the parties. We offer the parties the option for the virtual hearings at that stage. And then there's a number of things that we do suggest the tribunal discuss with the parties who are contemplating this. It really covers the logistics, technology, and the actual conduct for the virtual hearing. So some of the items on there is a discussion really to proceed virtually or not. What do you do when you proceed or are contemplating proceeding over the objection of a party? Now, the rules, the international rules and our domestic rules as well, do provide the arbitrators with the authority to proceed over a party's objection. I think the main things that they have to contemplate, and Jason alluded to that, but they do have a duty to conduct the proceedings with a view to expedite the resolution of the dispute, provided that the parties are treated with equality. And they also can consider how technology could be used to increase the efficiency and economy of the proceedings. I think the treated with the equality is where I've seen some of the challenges. I have been on virtual hearings using other platforms, different parts of the world. The tribunal is faced with a party that just doesn't have the bandwidth. It is stalling, freezing, accessing issues. We had to have backup plans to use these telephonically. So I think that is the issue. And we're looking at, we're doing a slight revision of our rules, and we are going to address and add a few additional provisions to make it even clearer the ability to use technology, but factors that you should be considering. We do tell the parties that the place of arbitration, even in the virtual settings, as you would expect, will be deemed the seat of the arbitration as designated by the arbitral agreement or agreed to by the parties. And then it covers a few other things, really common sense things, but worth noting that you consider the security, you send out the invitation, the ICDR will do so with password protected only to the authorized attendees, so you want to make clear who's there. We automatically default to having people arrive into the virtual hearings, into the waiting room, and then we make sure that that list confirms with the list of authorized attendees, confirmed in advance by writing. I think the advanced testing, again, common sense, but sometimes people don't actually provide a test that is going to replicate what is going to take place during the actual virtual hearing. So you don't have all the parties accessing from the various areas of the world. So we do recommend test in actual conditions, really replicate what you're going to do for the virtual hearings. And the arbitrators also, in terms of witnesses, you have this issue where at any given time you want to know who's in the room. We have had arbitrators ask them to pan around 360 degrees. There is that idea that coaching could be an issue. And in fact, other institutions have reached out to us to set up some of these hearings, and that has been an issue of being able to pan and have total 360-degree view of the room where the witnesses are going to be. So the hearing schedules, logistical issues are also very important. I think, again, treating parties fairly. That issue that Jason mentioned is one that I've also encountered in cases when they're preparing the schedule. Does one side always have the morning slot depending on the time differences, giving the opposing counsel the afternoon slot or the evening when people are tired? I think the exhaustion factor, and, you know, we've all been on Zoom calls and hearings for a number of hours. You have to take that into account. The fact that you're trying to study and gain whatever information you can by body language or the commentary of the parties, it's so much more intense. And as you're looking at several different screens and documents, they do have to be shortened sessions. I do think you have to consider providing equal access to morning sessions, and considering the time differences and considering the exhaustion are all very important factors. Now, lastly, I'll just wrap it up from caseload trends. In the beginning, I think, and mostly through the transition, we did see a bit of a slowdown in the filings, but they've certainly upticked. We're seeing international infrastructure projects being impacted and starting to receive filings along those lines. I think we're going to see an uptick. Maybe there'll be a bit of a downturn next year because I don't think we fully have appreciated the economic impact that's going to affect many of us. Global industries, obviously, travel, tourism, infrastructure, they've been hit hardest, but the other shoe may still fall. So we're being optimistic, but we're being cautious, and we'll see how this pans out later on. So I'll turn it back over to you, Rekha.
Thanks so much, Louis. So you heard it, equality of arms issues institutions are facing head on. It's only natural then to try to take into consideration the arbitrator perspective. With that, we're going to open up another question before we hand it to Lucas. Here it goes. What is the impact of COVID-19 on arbitral tribunals' willingness to make difficult decisions? Please weigh in there. As you're doing that, we're going to turn it over to Lucas. We'll leave the poll open and come back to your responses. Lucas, talk to us about tribunal boldness, the intersectionality also with tribunals working with arbitral institutions to effectuate change. The floor is yours.
Thank you. I think let's start from a historical fact. The idea of some sort of a hybrid hearings has been here for a very long period of time. I think I haven't done a face-to-face terms of reference hearing for a very long period of time, even pre-COVID, because it was economically not right to travel and have other people traveling just to agree on terms of reference. I have done it only twice in both cases where on the respondent side, in one case, and on the claimant side on the other case, we had state parties. And state parties like a bit of a formalism in certain adoption of procedural decisions. And one actually was hosted by a ministry in a particular jurisdiction. So everyone was happy to travel. There were no costs associated with the hearing itself, but it was cost with getting to the hearing. What has happened since March, however, is that this sort of interesting, intriguing sort of technological part of the hearing, which was either an online case management call or a procedural hearing, which is done on the phone or a video conference, or the odd witness being examined by video conference, now has changed so significantly that everything was online. And that had a twofold impact. One was purely cultural. It did impact quite a bit on this, let me use the word carefully, old world, predominantly men arbitrators, who used to like to travel to the hearing venue a day or 2 days before the actual hearing, have a beautiful dinner, expensive wines, and sort of very fine restaurants. Now you realize that you move from your bedroom, you change from your pajamas into your suit or just certain tie, and move into the hearing. So that cultural aspect of arbitration being an event has disappeared. And the other thing, of course, it exposed sort of attitudes to technology. In my very first online hearing after COVID, one of my co-arbitrators was a retired Court of Appeal judge, and she really had no particular ease with using technology. So she asked the court reporters to deliver a second computer to her place and asked her clerks to go and assist her with setting it up. The other arbitrator, retired judge as well, had no problem with technology whatsoever. So everything has been done very swiftly. And as an academic doing quite a bit of arbitration work, technology, use of Zoom, use of BlueJeans, use of Microsoft Teams have not been unknown to me, and I converted very quickly. Now, 6 months later, a lot of people have really got much better with that. So this novelty has been replaced by perhaps a fatigue. There was a question about we should have a half-day hearings, and you hear a lot of English lawyers, particularly barristers, that they would suggest that no hearing should be more than 4 hours. The traditional barristerial type hearing in the case from 10 or 10:30 to 4:30, because people prepare in the evening for the following day. But I have done hearings which were from 8:30 in the morning to 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and to accommodate in the same week, alternating every other day from 1 in the afternoon to 8 o'clock in the evening, so that we can balance the sort of the challenges of the parties. What I think now happens is also that technology has adapted even in terms of presentation of evidence. I mean, a lot of the providers have a platform for the electronic presentation of evidence. You can project documents, you can sort of highlight. But again, there is a level of asymmetry. I mean, there are a number of very able lawyers across the world that have never had access to this expensive software that certain companies offer. There's a problem that a lot of the online hearings are done on third-party providers. AAA, ICDR, or the ICC do not have their own online platform for hearings. So we rely on third-party providers, and there's additional issues of security. I understand that the ICC is considering developing their own technology for online hearings that will deal particularly with the question of multilingual hearings and translations. Although the hearing I was mentioning last week, which was going from either from 8:30 to 5 or from 1 to 8, did have translation, and this worked incredibly, incredibly well. So tribunals then have to inform the parties, and they have to work with the parties, and case management is paramount. I wouldn't go as far as to say that the Prague rules is the model of case management, but certainly everyone in these times welcomes a managerial or proactive tribunal, and that will assist parties make better decisions and go along. So I have seen that level of boldness, for lack of a better word, that it has worked reasonably efficiently, but communicating with the parties and explaining why a particular decision is being taken is very, very critical indeed. So I think technology and arbitration will work very well together. And we have to mention that AAA was perhaps the first provider of dispute resolution services that had an online submission system from back to 2003, I think, if I'm not mistaken. ICC followed very briefly after that, but the majority of lawyers were really reluctant to use them. Now that's a matter of the past. So tribunals are in a learning curve, very much as parties are in a learning curve. But now, if one is sort of accepting the fact that we can learn and we can change the ways we work, there are a number of very good virtual protocols at the moment, and therefore tribunals can use a lot of these already sort of pre-prepared prefab tools, prefabricated tools by institutions or other organizations to help them getting where they want to get. So, and I think tribunals are a bit out of the comfort zone, but I am pretty sure that they're starting to react quite well. I do, one final point I wanted to make. There was a question about what happens with site inspections. Can we have site inspections? I had the construction arbitration hearing, and one of the parties has used a drone to do a pretty short video of the whole highway, the whole length of the highway, and explain where the particular problems were in their own case. Of course, the other side, the employer, objected significantly to having that video admitted on evidence. Of course, it was a merely demonstrative exhibit. It was not an evidence of anything. And the tribunal found it very helpful. Of course, 6 or 10 minutes, what it was, a drawn video was a very heavy file. It took quite some time to download. There are issues there we need to get to used on how we get along that. But that was, it was such a good sort of camera work that it was almost as good as being on site and seeing what the problems were and why the design of that particular highway had to change or how has changed in reaction to certain sort of discussions. So it's a moving sort of target, and I think people are getting better at that. What I do think is that we should not exaggerate the reality that the virtual fatigue, sort of being in front of a screen for a very long period of time, is not healthy physically or mentally, and perhaps either one has to opt for shorter hearings or hearings where they have more than traditional 10 or 15 minutes coffee break, simply because it's appropriate for the parties to stand up for a minute and sort of to recollect their thoughts. I think that's where I would stop for this particular segment.
Okay, thank you so much, Lucas. Just to highlight the responses to the poll, we're seeing from the delegates more cautious arbitrators being the impact of COVID-19 and difficult decisions that have to be made. We're going to shift now into a conversation both with Lucas and Jason, two of the key component drafters of the survey, on the expansion of stakeholders in the international arbitration space that includes now expert consultants and third-party funders. And so how do these additions help drive us towards efficiency? I'm going to take the liberty of also just posing to them, since they were two of our big drafters on it, if you can also weigh in after you respond to that on what surprised you about the survey. I'll turn the floor over to you, to Lucas, to Jason, please.
Okay, Lucas, do you want to say something about experts, first of all?
Yes, agreed. I think expertise is key, and there's always a dilemma as to whether you have a tribunal that is technically expert, but not necessarily case management expert in deciding the case, or have a tribunal which is very good in case management, but not necessarily having technical expertise. The difficulty here, the dilemma, is that the tribunal has to make a decision on the basis of the evidence presented to them, rather than delegate the decision-making process to the expert. I think that's really the challenge, and there is evidence that in some cases where the tribunal was completely agnostic on a particular topic, effectively they had to go with one or the other expert, and they delegated the decision-making part of their job to the experts, which can be okay in some circumstances, but it can be tricky or even unacceptable in others. Experts can be very, very expensive. Sometimes one sees that experts are as expensive as lawyers or lawyers and arbitrators together. So one has to be very careful about managing, again, parties' expectations. And I think experts can be part of the cost reduction. There are, however, experts, and I will not name a person, but there was a particular lady who was a delay expert. And in a case that I have been working, I was chairing a few years back, she really made the tribunal understand where the delay was and how, so the whole sort of damages calculation operated. It was not that she was good at what she was doing, but she was a good communicator. And I think that level of communication is something that some experts lack if they're a bit aloof about what they do or geeky in what they do. But it's important that arbitrators work well with experts.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time to talk too long about experts, but I just add, in the construction space, joint expert reports and getting the experts to identify and agree and narrow the issues is key to efficiency and resolving disputes. And as common law lawyers, we just assume that's the case in all jurisdictions, and of course it isn't. And a lot of jurisdictions, a lot of civil law jurisdictions, for example, Stockholm, that's not the default at all. And your expert is very much your expert, and you don't have joint reports unless that's agreed. So I think there is certainly some movement there to be had, and I think that was something that was picked up by the survey. I was asked to just say a few words about third-party funding. That, of course, goes hand in hand with the cash flow issues that we're seeing in the sector that Claire alluded to earlier on. What was really interesting, and I guess it's one of the surprising points of the survey, or maybe I shouldn't be too surprised, but around two-thirds of the respondents, so 60%, said that they had no experience at all of third-party funding in construction arbitration. Of course, that was up till the end of last year. I think that will change. As with the 2008 financial crisis, which fueled a rise in arbitration and litigation in the construction sector for nearly 10 years, I suspect the COVID crisis, coupled with the oil price issues that we've seen, is very likely to do the same. Failing businesses will need rescues, contract defaults, unpaid claims are all going to need resolutions. And I think where parties weren't necessarily looking at the funding option before, I think it's going to become an increasingly attractive option to fund those claims and disputes off balance sheets. Interestingly, we, and this is why I'm slightly surprised by the survey, as a firm, we're already seeing third-party funding becoming more prominent in the construction sector before COVID, because cash was tight. And there had been a shift because I think it's fair to say 2 or 3 years ago, funders weren't necessarily massively interested in construction disputes because of most construction disputes, large construction disputes, tend to involve many claims and counterclaims, and they're very fact heavily reliant. Funders, I think, saw it as a risk because for them, it was much more difficult to get to the real value of the dispute as part of their assessment they make up front. So they tended to shy away from construction disputes. I think that's changed. It was starting to change before COVID. And we're certainly seeing now that there's more appetite by funders to fund claims in the construction sector when previously they weren't so attractive. In the context of efficiency, which is what the survey was about, I thought one point that was really well made is by some respondents is that third-party funding can often lead to an earlier resolution of the case because once the other side is made aware that you're funded, either directly or indirectly, it can often force them to reassess their risk. And if you think about it, funders tend to invest only if a case is well north of 50% chance of winning. Some funders actually insist on a much higher percentage than that. I've seen up to 60%. So that can be quite a powerful message to get out to the other side at the right moment, either in the mediation or at a particular pinch point in arbitration. Funding, I think it has to be the right case, of course. And those who don't know, funders tend to reverse engineer when they're looking at a case. So the first question they will ask is, can you enforce the award? Because obviously, if you can't enforce the award, there's not much point embarking on this happy endeavour. So that's the first question. The second question you ask is, what is the true value of the case? So your claim may well be $100 million, but is it really $10 million? Is it $50 million? What is the true value? So they want that sort of assessment. And that's critical for funders because in terms of the ratios in which many of them invest, which tends to be a 1-4, 1-5 ratio, it impacts how much money they're going to invest because, as I say, whatever they invest, they want it to be a sufficient margin in the actual recovery to make sure that the funded party has enough skin and incentive in the game to prosecute the claim. And then, of course, they look at the merits. And as I said, that sometimes it is north of 50%, sometimes as high as 50% chance of winning before they decide to invest. So it has to be the right case. But if it is the right case, it can be a very powerful way of allowing parties to bring their claims where they might not necessarily be able to do so because the funding will be non-recourse. So if you lose, you don't have to give it back. But of course, if you win, then the funder will want a share of the winnings, usually an uplift on the amounts that they've put in. The only other point I would make is be aware, because funding is not necessarily permissible in every jurisdiction, in every seat. Or at least it might not be permissible on the terms you're trying to seek to agree with your funder. So certainly careful advice needs to be taken from local council in that jurisdictional seat before entering into any funding arrangement. So with that, I will hand back to Rekha for some questions.
Thank you so much. We're going to take another poll. So here we go. The final poll.
I wanted to, because you asked me and I have not replied, but to what surprised me about the survey. And I think one of the interesting things about the construction industry was the adjudication, that dispute boards are used quite extensively as a pre-arbitral method of dispute resolution, dealt primarily by engineers and not by lawyers. And I was, the messages were very, very mixed. I mean, the majority of the respondents, almost two-thirds, are in favor of voluntary compliance, so pay and then bring the case, in other words. But in the interviews, that went both ways, and it was interesting that although a lot of people see adjudication as a particular positive features of arbitration, in practical terms, it was mixed result, and perhaps because people are influenced by the last case they had. If they've lost, they are not happy with that, and if they won, they are happy.
Thank you, Lucas. I appreciate that. I want to just bring up the poll results so you all can see them. So impact of COVID-19 on ongoing arbitrations, we are seeing overwhelmingly from the crowd, you're seeing a delay in your proceedings. It speaks even more so, right, towards efficiency in the conversations that we're having and the interviews that have already been had by Jason, by Lucas, and by others. We're going to go into just an open and general session round, asking a few questions generally to our speakers to weigh in on. And so with that, one of the questions that was posed in the Q&A was this idea of site visits. Lucas touched upon it, but I thought let's bring it to the practitioner's perspective as well. How do you deal with site visits in pandemic? Clea, Jason, would you like to weigh in and give that broader perspective?
Well, I've haven't had to yet, but I do recall we had an FPSO dispute in Singapore many, many years ago, and the tribunal wanted a site inspection, and they could physically attend that inspection, which they did. But interestingly, it was videoed at the same time, and so that video then could be looked at and relied on later on during the course of the arbitration. And I suspect that is something that's going to happen. So to the extent the site inspection is conducted remotely, it will be recorded. I think the key is going to be the participants who are sitting remotely, what input they have in controlling that inspection in terms of what's looked at, how it's looked at, how it's agreed. And I suspect there'll have to be some protocols in place, a little bit like protocols for joint sampling or joint testing of products, etc., before the inspection happens. But I've actually not done one yet, so I can't actually give you my practical view on that.
There, Clea, anything else to add there?
Well, unfortunately, like Jason, I've not yet had the issue arise on any of the matters that I'm working on currently, but we have had service providers who, on construction matters, offer services, not in terms of site disputes, but in terms of modelling types of 3D imaging and things like that, that they provide for hearing support, offering services along this line as well, and offering to provide either drones or robots or 3D model site visits that can be provided for parties. So there are technological whizzes out there who are finding ways to make it possible in the absence of being able to be there in person in real time.
Great. I'm going to pose a question to Luis about the increased use of ADR methods in general. Are you seeing in the cases that you're having at ICDR more access and party desire to go to mediation in advance? What overall are your insights?
I haven't seen anything I can track yet statistically about using more mediation, although what I have seen was this heretofore reluctance to mediation to be conducted virtually now disappearing. Those that are opting into doing it virtually are really coming away, and the feedback we're getting in the exit interviews was that they were pleasantly surprised. The mediators were pleasantly surprised. Once they were comfortable with the idea of the technology, the breakout rooms to have reproduce the caucus sessions privately and they were comfortable that they weren't crossing any of the boundaries in terms of what communications they were sharing or accidentally giving away confidential viewpoints that weren't to be shared. I just think that it was a very positive development. And to me, it continues to be so. We are actually called upon now to participate in these mediations and manage the Zoom technology part of it for the mediators and the parties. And I myself am pleasantly surprised. It's working quite nicely.
Resilience in the community. I'm going to raise a question broadly that was posed in the Q&A and Lucas has already answered, but it goes towards this, you know, as we're seeing an uptick of claims, may we also see an uptick in the challenge of awards? So Lucas, I know you weighed in, but if you can weigh in to all of our delegates on your perspective on that.
Yes, I think an increased challenge of awards is typical when the award debtor is impecunious. So one of the ways of avoiding to pay is to challenge the award. But I think cautious arbitrators speak for longer awards, very carefully worded, perhaps a bit sitting more on the fence. But all of these awards will be reasonably well sort of balanced and protected. I think where you see problems in the processes, in the case of a lack of experience, for example, arbitrators forgetting that the hearing might be recorded as well as having a court transcript. And perhaps you might say what you need to say, but you might, mannerism or some grimace or some surface reaction might lead the party to believe that an arbitrator was perhaps partial or biased towards a particular party or a particular witness or hostile. So these are the things perhaps which are a bit more of an issue here rather than the award itself. I think the awards continue to be as robust as they were, perhaps more, but perhaps becoming also a bit far too long, I think.
I'm going to stick with you, Lucas, on another question. Are you seeing an uptick in the use of techniques in advance of going to a virtual hearing that can help isolate issues and deal with them in advance of a hearing in chief? Maybe like a Kaplan hearing or other techniques you've heard of?
I think that's actually the indication of skill. It used to be part of certain arbitration rules, including the previous version of the LCIA rules, where a tribunal had to communicate to the parties the questions that they were planning to ask. And I have seen that I have sat with my co-arbitrators in some sort of a pre-hearing deliberation, and we had a list of questions and told the parties that they want them to focus on particular issues. This happens very often in the post-hearing submissions, but it's very useful to give that instruction to the parties before the hearing so their attention is focused. The problem is that a lot of people get very busy and they don't have this time about a month before the hearing to do the early reading and be instructed. But when it happens, it's very useful. Yeah. Whether you call it a Kaplan order or a hearing or whatever you call it, but that's effectively the issue. So narrowing the issues, in other words.
To Jason and to Clea, this idea of settlements, and so are remote hearings minimizing the use of settlements overall? What are you seeing?
Do you want me to answer that, or are you, Clea?
Well, we can't underestimate the ability for parties to look into the whites of each other's eyes across the table, or to sit in a room and hear the strength or the weakness of another side's arguments, and to see how their case may or may not be playing out in terms of a tribunal that's hearing it. And so to the extent that we are doing these things now behind a screen and we don't have the opportunities to reflect on those things and have our clients possibly kind of live in the moment and make decisions about whether or not they want to pursue a decision or not, there is, I suppose, a potential that settlements might not be quite as organic in that sense. It's the disputes I'm working on at the moment, the issue of whether settlement is or is not going to happen hasn't been affected by the circumstances and by us doing things remotely, but I can imagine that there's certainly a scope for that to happen. Jason, I don't know whether you agree or disagree.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think from my experience, I've been involved in the bifurcated arbitration. So the first liability hearing we had, everyone was present. We had the other side's decision makers and lawyers present who we regularly met in breakouts around the coffee machine. And there was a dialogue, there was a relationship, there was a connection. In the second hearing on quantum, which was run remotely, there were a dot on the screen. They weren't even on the screen. There were a dot on the screen. And there was no connection with them at all. So inevitably, it makes that opportunity for commercial discussions more difficult. Ultimately, I suspect it does come down to how parties' decision makers operate. So if some parties will send decision makers to hearings, then I think they're going to suffer, because unless we can find another way to keep open that commercial dialogue, maybe by possibility of separate virtual breakout rooms or chat rooms so that that dialogue can happen privately, I think it is going to impact on settlement. For parties who wouldn't necessarily send decision makers to hearings, it probably won't make too much of a difference in any event. But as I say, for parties that do, I think it makes it more difficult. There's no question about that.
Thank you. Cognizant of time, Luis, a final word from the institutional perspective, a tip to our delegates as we continue in pandemic.
Well, from the institutional perspective, I think I'll share a personal perspective. I can only hope that we make some medical or scientific breakthrough. This has to end. Unfortunately, many are suffering with some real tragedies. And on a personal note, I just missed the opportunity to be in a room with all of you in person and to see many good friends that we're all missing. So let's hope for a speedy end to this pandemic.
Thank you so much. Well, on behalf of each of our speakers, to all of the delegates, thank you for tuning in, for posting your questions, for doing the polls with us to help us get a better sense of things. It has been a sincere pleasure to be with you, and we'll be following up with more. So stay tuned. But thanks so much, and have a great rest of your day.